Welkom bij de podcast Zeker Weten. Gesprekken met wetenschappers die in God geloven. Gaat dat samen, geloof en wetenschap? Vandaag spreken we met cultuurwetenschapper Paulina Lucas, universitair docent in Leiden. Zij vertelt hoeveel invloed je cultuur heeft op hoe je een Bijbelverhaal uitlegt.
Hey everyone, thanks for tuning into another conversation. Today we are talking about culture and religion. My name is Marina De Haan. I work as a journalist and a writer. Next to me is Eline.
Hi, Marina. Nice to be here again.
Yeah, good to have you too.
I'm a journalist for the Dutch Daily Nederlands Dagblad as a newspaper. We're here with Paulina Lucas. Nice to meet you. Paulina, you're not from the Netherlands. You're from Chile. Mm-hmm. What is the biggest culture shock that you ever had?
Okay, well, hi, both of you. Thank you so much for having me. So as you said, yes, my name is Paulina Lucas, and I come from Chile. The biggest cultural shock here in the Netherlands? Mm-hmm. The lunch. My very first cultural shock, probably the broodje kaas for lunch. Coming from a culture where lunch is a very big part of your day and you take a long break and have a warm prepared lunch. Mm. Coming here to see everyone just, you know, eating a broodje kaas of a cracker sometimes was hard to get used to. Mm.
And not having a siesta afterwards?
Yeah, I think that the siesta, at least where I came from, my city is pretty big, so siestas are something for the weekend. Mm. But somehow we still managed to sneak in a big lunch, even at work. So, yeah.
Because from which city in Chile are you?
I'm from the capital, Santiago. So I was born and raised there, and the pace of life is very fast. It's a really big city. It has almost 9 million inhabitants, which means that the distances are also very, very big. So getting places and just doing your life takes a lot more energy than in the Netherlands. That's one of the very positive cultural shocks that I've had here, that life quality is just so much incredibly better.
Mm, so you're saying Dutch culture is a bit more slower than?
I don't know if I would call it slower. I think that it has to do with the way that you've organized your cities. But also, speaking about the sandwiches for lunch, inevitably that just helps you be more productive. Mm. So you don't have that post-lunch sort of unproductive couple of hours where you're sort of working but not really, mm-hmm. Because you should be taking a siesta, but you're not. So in that sense, I think that Dutch people are just better at focusing and at doing, you know, their work or whatever needs to be done in the time that needs to be done. And then they can go and really log off and just go with their bikes or gardening or whatever hobby they have. You see that. You didn't see that, or I didn't see that growing up. It was just work, 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 and then just falling exhausted somewhere.
Mm. All right. And in this podcast, we're talking about culture and religion and how they affect one another. Yeah. So I would like to hear something from the way that you're from Latin America. How did that culture affect your religion? Are there typical things for Latin American Christians?
Okay, well, that's a big, big question. Maybe let me give you a little bit of background before I answer. So I did my studies in Latin American literature and then my master's in Latin American cultural studies or cultural analysis, really. And now I work teaching work groups in cultural analysis, Latin American cultural analysis and global cultural analysis at the International Studies Program in Leiden University. So when you speak about religion, in particular Christianity in Latin America, I think that it is important to keep in mind that it is that it doesn't have the status that it has in Europe, even though Europe right now is very secular and secularized, and religion has sort of taken a, you know, a side seat. In Latin America, Christian non-Catholic religions, at least when I was growing up, were still very stigmatized, and were still very, very small. Now, of course, they are larger, but they are related to other, to other cultural cultural issues. So I think that for me growing up, I was at this sort of crossroads, or at this third space where I was growing up evangelical with a pastor for a grandfather, and my mom worked in an international NGO that was a Christian NGO. So faith was from the beginning very, very present in my life. But at the same time, I realized that it didn't click with where I lived or where I went to school. And so I grew up from very young age trying to defend my faith and explain my faith to everyone else, because for the majority of, in that moment, Chilean people, but I would say that Latin American people in the 90s and the early 2000s, the default religion was Catholicism. Exactly. And you would have people that were genuine practicing Catholics, but everyone else would just be nominal Catholics, because it was seen as something very, very, not good to not be. It was, if you were not Catholic, at least nominally, then you were probably a communist or just some sort of hippie that didn't believe in anything, right? I mean, this is the 90s. Now, of course, it's very different, the panorama, but it was like that back then. So in this midst, I would go to school and I would say, no, I'm actually not Catholic. I don't believe that the Virgin is the big deal that it is.
And what was their response?
Curiosity and a little bit of, I think in general, just curiosity. I don't think that I was never, bullied or anything for not being Catholic, but I was seen as like the odd duck there that was like, also because even though I went to a secular school, the religion classes were mandatory and they were Catholic religion classes. So my dad made a little bit of a scandal. And because this had never happened at a private school that was, sort of very... they didn't know how to deal with me, because no parent, even if they were not Catholic, would have removed their children from religion classes. So they just sent me to the library, which is where my love for books and literature comes from, because since I was 5 or 6, I've been going to the library on my own once a week while my classmates were having religion classes. So it was always very evident. I always wore my faith and my religion on the outside. It was very evident for everyone, and I just had to grow very comfortable very quickly with the fact that I was different.
Was that difficult for you to feel different, or were you sure about your faith?
No, I mean, I was very sure. I was very sure about my faith. And at the same time, if I'm honest, there was always a component of shame, because being evangelical back then was the poor people's religion. It was, and to an extent, not anymore fully, but to an extent it still is seen like that. When I was growing up, especially, living in a certain part of the city, upper middle class, going to private school, the idea that you had when I said, or when anyone said the word evangelical, was someone in a slum playing accordion or tambourine at 8 a.m. on a Sunday, just waking everyone up and just sort of forcing this worship music on them with the hopes that they were going to convert. Yeah. That was what it meant to be evangelical. So I had to always explain that. And to be honest, I had to cross, and that gave me, I'm so grateful for that. I see it as a genuine blessing right now that I had to cross literally the city, but also social and class barriers because of my faith. Because my grandfather's church was not in the same part of the city that I lived. The kids that that were there and that grew to be my friends were definitely not going to the same kind of schools that I was going. That allowed me this mobility that none of my classmates had. And I was so grateful for that.
Mm-hmm. And you saw more of your country.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You said earlier about the pace in the city, and I was wondering, are there significant things about your culture, like hospitality, for example? What's typical for your culture?
Yes, I think that that hospitality and that that genuine curiosity for everyone else, especially, you know, as a foreigner, when you come, everyone is very excited to welcome you and to show you around. And I'm just trying to think what else is very, well, I guess now that I compare it with the Netherlands, right, I always see the Netherlands as this more sort of restrained, well-behaved society that just completely lets loose on King's Day or here in Leiden on October, right? Yeah. And then you see, oh, okay, Dutch people, huh, you had this in you. I didn't know that. Whereas I feel like in Latin America, there's this, we just are a little bit more chaotic constantly. We don't have these national holidays. I mean, we do, right? And then people really just are exuberant. But on a daily base, I think that, you know, you could say, I don't know if you're familiar with the Hofstede model of cultural interactions. And it's a Dutch model from, I don't know, a couple of decades ago, and a lot of churches and a lot of institutions use it to say, oh, this is a warm culture, this is a cold culture, this is a culture that values proximity, this is a culture that values hierarchy. In the Netherlands, there is virtually no hierarchy, right? Mm-hmm. We're all the same, but in Chile and in Latin America in general, hierarchies are very, very important and are very much in place, to the point that, touching it on religion, for example, my grandfather being a pastor, you knew that was so different, even though, you know, theologically speaking, we're all equally, you mm-hmm. know, we all fall short in the same way. Mm-hmm. There is this special reverence for the pastor of a church. There is a special reverence for teachers. There is a special reverence for anyone who is in a position of authority to you. Positions of authority are very present in your life, I think. Mm-hmm.
So that's an example of how culture influences religion.
Mm, definitely.
Like the place that a pastor has and how you look up to the pastor and everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now you live in the Netherlands with your French husband.
Yes.
What's his name?
Jérôme.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. you can say Jeroen, though.
Oh. Like,
we are happy to Dutchize our
names. No, Jérôme.
Yes.
Much too beautiful to pronounce it in Dutch. What can you tell us? What brought you here?
Yes,
together?
Sure. Well, our masters, really. Hmm. So I was studying literature in Santiago, and I was absolutely determined to go to Germany. I'm so sorry, Netherlands.
Aww.
I am so sorry, Netherlands.
We're stopping this interview.
I know. I think so. The minute I started university, even though I was studying Latin American literature, I knew that I needed to study German, and I wanted to apply for a program at a German university. So for me, it was very, very intentional, and I spent a lot of time studying German, applying, getting grants, etc. And I got accepted at Heidelberg University to do my exchange program there. And at the same time, in a very different part of the world, my French husband, who was studying at Cardiff in Wales, He was also thinking, okay, I need to do my year abroad. And someone just suggested, hey, why don't you try Germany? So, you know, that's how different we are. And he's like, oh yeah, sure. Okay, I'll try it.
Why
so
not?
We ended up both in Heidelberg, and we were going to the same church. So I like to say that we met at church, but really we met at a club. I think it was my second Sunday at this German church, and they told us that they were gonna go partying. So I thought, what? Christians go dancing? is this a thing that happens? Being a Latin American, I love dancing, but it was so frowned upon. It's not something that you would gloat about at church.
Mm-hmm.
And even though most of us were still going dancing on a Saturday, then there had to be no trace of that on a Sunday morning.
Okay.
You would definitely not invite your church friends to go dancing, right? So when I heard this, I was like, oh,
Yes, that's your please.
So that's where we met, and yeah. after a lot of long distance and dating and so on, he moved to Chile for a year, and that's where we started seriously thinking, okay, let's look for masters. And we looked everywhere in Europe. We were seriously considering the UK, and then he said, "I found the perfect university. It's Leiden," and I'm like, "Where is that?"
I had no idea where
Ouch.
It was.
I am so sorry. And then, of course, we found out. I was like, how did we not know about it? It's an excellent university and it's in the Netherlands. Neither of us had never been to the Netherlands. And we thought, okay, let's apply. We both applied. We got in. And then we went to France, I think, maybe a month before the semester started. We got married at a town hall. And 3 days later, we came to the Netherlands thinking... Wow. We'll stay for a year while our masters last, and then we're, you know, on our way to conquer the world. And 9 years later, here we are, eating pindakas.
Pindakas.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you're from Chile, your husband is French. Yeah. Do we see those both of those cultures in your family, and how?
You see them, and I think that right now, ironically, you see them more in contrast with the Dutch culture, because French, there are elements that that we try to highlight from our cultures, aside from the language, obviously, that are very different in Dutch. So, for example, one thing that we do as a family is that we do Sunday lunch. Sunday lunch is a big deal. So we prepare it. We usually do either a roast chicken or maybe a barbecue if the weather is nice. And the kids look forward to that the whole week. So after church or something, then we have Sunday lunch, and it's it is pretty big. Nice. But aside from that, the main things is obviously language.
Yeah, and we're talking about culture and religion. Maybe it's good to define those. What's your definition of culture and of religion, because you're a lecturer in cultural studies.
Yeah, and religion is definitely something that I'm very interested in. So I would say that when we talk about culture, there's two sort of big and somewhat different definitions, right? The first one is what everyone thinks about, that it has to do with countries, right? It's like, oh, I love Chinese culture, for example, or, oh, I love European culture. So that would be one understanding of culture, and that has to do a lot with, for example, the Hofstede model of saying, oh, certain cultures, as in countries, are this way, and certain cultures are this way, and that helps a lot international churches, for example. But then there's another definition of culture that is more innate to everyone, right? And it has to do with our behavior, with how we understand things, with how we, you know, even from the beginning, something cultural would be how you decide to gather food, for example, how you decide to prepare that food, how do you do your hair, if you do your hair, if you don't, right? So that is also culture. The decisions that we make every day, the behaviors that we have, are also culturally impacted. And that can change by location, but it can also change generationally. It can change with time, etc. So those two factors, I think, have a big influence in how we perceive religion. And then you were asking for religion as well. And I think that I'm going to sound very pedantic, but religion, the word originally comes from Latin, religare, right? And that means to bring back together, to connect again. And I think that's a beautiful metaphor for Christianity, for bringing back humanity with God, right? But I think that if I'm honest, when nowadays in our society we think about religion, we think not about this beautiful metaphor, we think about institution.
Yeah, exactly.
We think about something very institutionalized,
with rules, with
structures, and obviously those rules, those structures are also very cultural. And I think that one of the biggest dangers, if we want to put it that way, that we have every single, you know, generation of believers, is that we tend to think that the very cultural given structures of our particular religion are gospel truth.
Ah.
Because it is very hard to differentiate, you know, good-willing Christians. It is very hard for us to differentiate what is gospel and what are the structures, the cultural structures that we put around it so that that can work. Because for a church to work, for an organization to work, for an institution to work, you need a certain structure around it, like a scaffolding, right? Mm. And those structures are inevitably given by culture. And that is why there's these slight changes or differences in how you do church in China than in how you do church in the Netherlands than how you do church in Latin America.
Can you give an example of what is cultural in those structures that you have? Maybe, for example, in the Netherlands, that is different from what you know from Latin America?
Well, one example, the obvious one would be the hierarchy that we were speaking about before, right? Here, and because I go to an international church, it's very, very funny to still come across it every time someone new comes to the church. You can tell more or less how their culture shapes their view because of how they call the pastor. So after, you know, living so long in the Netherlands, and for me being more an international than a Latin American at this point, I call my pastor Andy and Helen. Also, they are friends. But some people, after even years of living here, they categorically refuse to say anything other than Pastor Andy. And treat him with that distance, with that respect, right? So that would be one thing, but also the way that we worship would be another, right? And maybe the way that we worship right now, that is something that I'm very interested about, because inevitably it has become synonym with singing, and that's been for decades now, right?
Yeah.
But even the kind of worship songs that we use, I think that there has been definitely I don't want to use the word monopolization, but there's been this, I think that now we don't necessarily have a lot of different cultures or a lot of different influences in the way that, for example, we choose the music that we worship to.
Yeah.
You will hear Hillsong and Bethel in the Netherlands and in Latin America and in China and in the United States.
Yeah.
I personally think that that's a shame. I think that we're losing a lot of our own theology and our own culture and the vitality that brings to the table by having one standardized way of doing church, one standardized way of doing worship, of doing communion, of doing, you know, so many things.
Yeah, I like what you said earlier about the definition of religion, like the word. In the Netherlands, we're actually a bit afraid of the word religion. We prefer relationship.
Yeah.
What's your view on that? And perhaps should we change that definition of religion again?
Well, I think that would be a beautiful sort of intention. I definitely understand. I think that it is a stained word, religion, everywhere, at least everywhere in the Western world. Right now, no one is proud to say, "Ooh, I'm a religious person." It is actually something that you would hear kind of offensively, right? Mm. Oh, you're religious.
Exactly.
Oh, she's religious. Yeah. You know? Mm-hmm. And I think that it would be beautiful to try to rescue the word. But also, I think that, you know, if we move with what's happening right now and the language that we use, relationship, it is also a beautiful word that brings us back to that same origin anyways.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you talked about the way they affect each other. And I lost my question.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
So religion and culture, they affect each other. Can they complement each other as well?
Absolutely. It's just that I think that we tend to see religion and culture as two separate things, but they are part of the same weaving. There is no religion as we understand it without culture. There is culture without religion, but barely, I would say. Because even though we have people that are obviously non-believers, atheists, you know, different cultures, different religions, our religious past, as humans, we have still historically in every single culture, in every single part of the world, seeking that connection, right? That reconnection, that re-ligament with whatever is out there. So I think that culture without religion is as difficult to think about as religion without culture. Mm. They definitely influence each other, but only if we're thinking about religion as institution and culture as either, you know, pop culture or as the cultures of countries. Mm-hmm. But if we understand culture as something that is imminent to us and that is part of how we make decisions and that is part of our cosmovision and how we understand things, then it is, you know, definitely, but yes. So I think that they definitely influence each other. They influence our theology as well. I think that if I can say, if I can give one example of that, my husband became a Christian when he was in university. So his Christian experience has been very Anglo focused. He became a Christian in the UK, and then here in the Netherlands, being in an international church, it is still, you know, very Anglo focused. Mm. So when we read the story of Joseph in the Bible, right? Joseph being sold by his brothers and then going through all of this journey to, into becoming this very important person in Egypt and then eventually forgiving his brothers and so on, right? I read that from this Latin American theology that was heavily influenced by the American theology of the 70s and 80s, right? Of, oh, poor Joseph, he's done wrong. Oh, poor, I mean, not he's done wrong, but he has, but something terribly bad happened to him. He was the chosen one. Mm. He was the hero of the movie. And because his brothers were so jealous, then, you know, they sold him. But it doesn't matter because God rescued him out of all of these terrible circumstances into becoming what he was really meant to be, right? Mm-hmm. That was the perspective with which we read that story. And then we heard a podcast about 2 months ago of how there was this other way to read this story. And we commented that with Dutch friends. Mm-hmm. And our Dutch friends were like, that's not new. That's how we read the story. Mm-hmm. And so how they read the story or how they understood the story was Joseph made a huge mistake of being extremely pretentious and and trying to be better than everyone else. And of course, it was not warranted, but, you know, something terribly bad happened to him. But Joseph was definitely not a chosen one or the hero of the movie, like, you know, that we had read. And then Joseph kept on having all of these very human failures, and God was gracious and blessed him through it, but not because he was this hero or the chosen one from the beginning.
But in spite of all his shortcomings.
Exactly. Yeah, precisely. And so that's a way that two different cultural approaches can impact the way that you read the same story.
Yeah. And speaking about how culture inflicts your theology, in some Dutch churches, there's a big discussion about, for example, what women may or may not do in church. Can they speak? May they be in charge of the church?
Leadership.
And in some of those churches, the discussion is about whether or not they are as a church following the culture in the Netherlands where women can be leaders, or that will be wrong to follow the culture in that. Mm-hmm. And they point that, or what they place against it is to be pure Christians and reading the Bible as though culture has nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
And it's pure theologically placed out there.
So this is what I mean when I say that that sometimes we take cultural elements or the cultural structure around our faith and we call that gospel. I think that it is such a delicate job that we need to sort of learn and unlearn certain elements. But but just to answer sort of the first part of your question, I would think that that it's a very unfair thing that churches do when they call culture the way that I grew up, you would call it the world.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly, yeah.
You are going to follow the world, the culture.
Very dangerous, very bad.
As if we all lived in this precious Christian bubble and outside of us was the world, always waiting to burst us and to come inside and contaminate everything. Mm. And even when we read the Bible, we realize that that's not it. We don't live in a precious bubble. We live in the world. Mm-hmm. But I think that is not a helpful distinction to make, to say we are the church and then there's the culture. No, like we need, I think that it would be a greater advantage for Christians to see how culture is present in our churches, how culture is present, to not be afraid. I think that is something that you see also here in the Netherlands. I met for the first time, for example, and I hope that no one gets offended, people who had grown up not reading Harry Potter because that was, you know, like culture in the world.
Yeah.
And you didn't want to be contaminated with that. I think that coming from the background of cultural analysis, as a mom myself, right, I want my children to be able to engage with culture in a way that is effective, and that is gospel-like. So I want them to be able to ask questions. Mm. I want to be able to have those conversations with them instead of that constant dance of avoidance. Avoid this, avoid that. Sure, there's seasons in our lives and there's moments. I mean, my kids are little. I'm not going to have them, you know, read or watch movies that are going to be terribly scary for them right now in the name of culture. But when the age comes, when the time comes, I do want them to be able to engage in that and give them the tools and equip them so that they can ask pertinent questions and so that they can have a conversation with a cultural product or with a different culture, with a different perspective on things without feeling like having any contact is going to make them lose their faith, right?
Yeah.
But on the same hand, it's for Christians sometimes a good thing to be in contrast to society,
to stand out,
to show with how you dress, the language you speak, what you do or don't do as a woman. Mm-hmm. Like you can show that you're different. Mm-hmm. Is that something, or is that also culture? Is that religion for you, or do you say that's culture within religion?
I think that you can't just have a clear cut. You can't just say this is, because then we fall into the same potential mistake of saying, oh, this is religion, this is where the gospel is, and this is what authority, you know, do I or anyone else have to call this bad and this good, or this counterculture in a good way and this counterculture in a bad way, right? I think that is a very personal, that has to do with intention. And that's why I love this part in the gospel where Jesus says that, or in the Old Testament as well, right? Where God says, you see faces, but I see hearts.
Mm.
I think that it has to do with where it comes from, right? You know, as you're saying, for example, the way that women dress or the way that, or the roles that they are going to take in their churches, My theological view is that women are meant to be in places of leadership along with men.
Mm-hmm.
But that is my theological view. And I've come here from a journey and from a place of, okay, this is where I'm at right now, right? But that's the beauty of church as well. That's the beauty of community. I think that if we can't open our communities and our churches for people that are still God-loving brothers and sisters but have different views than us, then I would say that we're potentially doing it wrong. Mm. We often say, oh, our church is open for, you know, for the clearly sinful people. Oh, alcoholics, you're welcome. We are going to accommodate. And that's fantastic, right?
Yeah.
But then when someone else claims to be Christian but is in the margins of what you understand as Christianity, we get a lot more precious.
Mm. Yeah.
We tend to draw a lot more lines there when someone claims to love Jesus like you do, but has a different view on something, political or cultural, right? Yeah. Then we say, oh, but no, that's, I don't compute that. I don't understand that. I think that for me, moving different countries and learning different cultures and languages and so on has been an experience of also opening up what that God is bigger than what I understand God to be. Mm. So not shutting the door on things that I don't agree on or things that I don't understand so quickly, to at least have a conversation.
Is it important, because in the Netherlands, we are a small country, but we practice religion in a very different way. For instance, in the city, it's completely different than on the other side of the country. How can we, or is it important to be in unity with one another?
Oh, I think that unity is such a... I think that as Christians, we're going to be grappling with the topic of unity until Jesus comes back. Mm. Jesus is going to come and he's going to say, you didn't sort it out, did you? And we're going to go, no, sorry. I think that there's a lot of grace for that. Yes, we should strive for unity. Yes, we should strive for love. I think that that's probably... One of the biggest examples that I have of that unity is being in an international church, and as a young couple, you know, newly married, 3 days, right, had no idea how to live adult life, let alone in the Netherlands. A very sweet older couple from church invited us for dinner, and so we're like, oh, that's so cool. So they, you know, they were not Dutch either; they were a different nationality, and we were, you know, we barely knew them, and we went to their house for dinner, and so we were telling them about ourselves, and I told them, yeah, no, I'm from Chile, but my background or my heritage is Palestinian. That's where my grandparents came from, and she just looks shocked, and she says, oh, you must be so ashamed. And I remember my husband putting his hand on my knee, kind of like, do not jump at her. Mm-hmm. We are guests in this house. Do not jump at her, right? And I thought, okay, we get through dinner and this is going to be one of those people that are just, you know, like, I don't really get along with in church and that's fine. And see, what happened next was that over the next couple of years, not only we grew to be close to that family, we grew to genuinely love each other, even though... we never asked of each other for our views to change or for our understanding of certain things to change. I think that when we speak about unity, we're essentially speaking about love, right? We are going to be known as Christians, not because of how we dressed or if we let women have positions of leadership or not, or, you know, if we vote a certain way or not. We are going to be known as Christian because we love each other. And I think that that is one of the biggest callings that we have right now. How do we find it? How do we on our hearts to love one another, even though we don't even need to speak about different cultures, right? Churches in Amsterdam and churches in the, you know, Bible Belt are radically different.
Yeah.
Can we find that love? Can we find that point of connection and let the rest not divide us?
Yeah. Built on love, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you go to an international church here in Leiden?
Yeah.
Okay. And there, that's a place where many cultures come together.
Definitely.
And all together are Christians and worship together. How does that work? Is it complicated? Is it enriching? How do you...
I would call it the most beautiful mess that you've ever seen. It is definitely enriching and complicated, not only because we are Christians from many different countries, but also because we're Christians from so many different backgrounds. Being the only English-speaking church in Leiden, you have people that are Catholics or people that are on the verges of different faiths that went to a very, very small, you know, denomination, for example, and they did things their own way. But now, by the need of having worship in English, then they end up here. So
no choice.
Yeah, exactly. Literally no choice. There is a big impact on how we do things, definitely.
And what is beautiful about it, about all those cultures coming together?
So our pastor has this way of saying it that I love. It's like we have a little preview of what's going to be like in heaven. Because if you think about it, there's Christians from every different background, every different nation, different expectations of what a Sunday should look like, different, you know, different everything, right? Different ways of relating to each other. So you have the super hug cultures like Latin America, and then you have more conservative Christians that grew up,
keep your distance.
Yeah, keep your distance, please. But you also have introverts and extroverts, and it's just that I think adds to the beauty, the difference, the diversity, really.
Mm-hmm. And when does it become complicated? Because, you know, your faith and your religion is also influenced by your background. And culture.
Yeah.
So I can imagine there are sometimes situations where that conflicts.
Yes, definitely. Whenever as leadership team, there needs to be decisions made. You need to take into account so many things. And in the end, you know that not everyone is going to be, you know, pleased. And I think that that's in any church, but it gets heightened in an international church because of the different expectations. So I think that, you just sort of, you navigate through it, really. Mm. Yeah.
And do you also put more of your own views aside to follow the church's view?
It's a difficult question because ICL is not the kind of church that is an exclusive club. So either you're in with all of our views or you're out, right? Yeah. If anything, they are incredibly open and incredibly welcoming. That being said, you know, sermons are going to be, for example, silly example, we don't do baby baptisms, for example, which some denominations and some churches do. And if you want to have your baby baptized, then you are welcome to keep on attending our church and have your baby baptized in another church, right?
Oh, wow.
So in that sense, we're not going to, you know, kick anyone out because
So you agree to disagree on certain, but is there a point where you say, well, this is something you don't disagree about, this is the basis, or does it become more clear what your common ground is because of all those differences?
I mean, I think that if we were a static community, the same group of people growing together over the years, it would become very clear, and then you would see people go for real and then come back for real, or, you know, or but the nature of any international church is that you're incredibly fluid. Because expats, you know, 2 years and then they're gone, or 3 years and then they're gone, or students 1 year or one semester and then they're gone. I think that I've never heard of anyone being like that's, you know, kicked out. I think that you journey with people, and sometimes people legitimately move to a different, you know, country, and sometimes they move on to a different church, and that's okay. I think that churches should never be a sort of exclusive club that if you don't follow, because the thing is that as a church, you're welcome to be part of it, to go there on a Sunday, even though, you know, you, even though you're not a believer, right? That's how that we literally invite people for that very reason, right?
Yeah, but not to talk about the outside of where you sort of could be kicked out or fall off or whatever, but to focus on the center of where do you find each other? Is that,
I think, we find each other in God, in our common ground. I don't know if that makes sense. So as internationals and as Dutch people that go to an international church, we have a common ground where we consistently find God. And that sometimes is, you know, being international parents without opas and omas in the country, and, you know, joining all together to take care of kids, or to, you know, help each other with groceries or whatnot. And sometimes that has to do with, with just experiencing, you know, God in this different space, different culture, different language, right? I think that that's where we all come together.
And how can people with different cultures inspire each other?
I think that there has to be a listening to each other first, right? You can't be inspired if you don't first listen carefully and attentively, and try to leave judgment outside of it, you know, before, I think, you know, listening without an agenda, right? And then you can really inspire each other.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Paulina, for this conversation.
En jij bedankt voor het luisteren. Tot de volgende aflevering.
Thank you.